All right, our next presentation is going to talk a little bit about the sports gambling landscape, and we're going to bring this story into 2019 a little bit after talking some about the mechanics of gambling in 1919. So Kevin P. Bragg is the partner with the law firm of Shoemaker, Loop, and Kendrick, LLP, and he is a member of the International Masters of Gaming Law and also an avid Cincinnati Reds fan, too. So we've got a little Reds representation. Please welcome Kevin Bragg.
Thank you very much. I'm new to Sabre. I was born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio, a football guy, and I have been with the Columbus chapter, the Hank Gowdy chapter, for just a few months, so this is the first time I've ever been to a Sabre event, and I think if Jacob would have told me I was going on after Dr. Dellinger, I'm not sure I would have agreed to it, so she was fantastic. I don't have a lot of baseball stories, but I did play high school football with Ken Griffey Jr. in Cincinnati. Junior was a year behind me, and I was a defensive back at Archbishop Mueller, and he was a wide receiver. So I covered Junior in practice every day when I was a senior in high school. And I tell that story a lot, and a few people have said, well, what was it like to cover Ken Griffey Jr. in high school? And I said, well, you know, do you ever see Junior when he played for Seattle or the Reds and, you know, hitter would smash a home, look like a sure homer to center field, and he'd go back and soar up above the wall and catch it and rob the guy of a homer, and the person inevitably would say, yeah, and I'd say, I know how the wall feels. He's a great athlete. So I've been practicing law now for 26 years, and I've been doing about the last 10 years of it in gaming law, and the past 3 years or so, it's been intensely involved with sports betting. And so that's what's sort of drawn me, along with my Cincinnati connection, to the 1919 World Series interest. And have looked at it a lot and looked at the betting on the series, both from a legal and from a bookmaking perspective. And it seems like that's an area in this story that still has a lot of room for exploration, both by myself and with other people. So what I wanted to talk to you about today was the business of betting in the early 20th century, both before the 1919 World Series, and then just a little bit at the end about how it relates to what's going on now, as we're seeing a lot of, quite frankly, what it probably looked like back in the early part of the 20th century, where betting was not a submerged industry, but rather was openly talked about and part of the story. So to start off to understand, you have to understand that when we talk about there's gambling, and of course people bet on everything going back to ancient times. But the business of betting, for the purposes of the World Series, you really start with, the story starts in 1904, and what happened in 1904 was, at that time, if you were a bookmaker, if you were in the business of betting, what you really were doing was you were taking bets on horse races. Horse races would have been 99% of all the professional betting that would be being done. And the betting would occur in two places. It would occur on course at the track, of course, but it also would occur off course. It would occur in what they would call pool rooms. And these pool rooms were not necessarily a billiard parlor, although it might have been a billiard parlor, but it also would have been a cigar stand in a hotel, frequently a back room in a saloon. And generally what those would be called just generally would be a pool room, or sometimes you'd see it referred to as a handbook. And where those off-course betting parlors would get their information on the horse races, you know, who were the horses, how did they finish, were there any scratches, who were the jockeys, they would get it from Western Union. Western Union would type it in from the tracks and send it out to all these pool rooms, and that's where they got it, and they bet. If you've ever seen the movie The Sting, that's what they're setting up in The Sting, is one of these pool rooms. And The Sting takes place in 1934, which is about 10 years after the pool rooms have kind of gone out of business because the radios come along. And there's an early scene where Paul Newman and Robert Redford and all the gang are sitting around, and they're trying to figure out what con they're going to play on Doyle Lonergan. And one of them says, let's do the wire room. And Paul Newman says, yeah, that went out 10 years ago. He probably doesn't know it. So, but that's what we're talking about, are these pool rooms. And Western Union would supply them with the critical information that they needed until May 19th of 1904, when some of their board of directors, feeling pressure from outside sources, said, we're not doing this anymore. We are cutting the wire to the pool rooms. The public doesn't like it. It smacks of illegal gambling. And so just literally overnight, the off-course pool rooms didn't have any data. And what that did is that created a void, and the void was filled right here in Chicago. It created an intense competition between two professional gambling businesses here in Chicago. One was a fellow named Jim O'Leary, who ran a handbook down on the south side of Chicago, virtually in the shadow of the old Comiskey Park. And the other guy was a fellow named Mont Tennis. And Mont Tennis was here on the north side. And he had a network all up and down Clark Street here, right here in this neighborhood. And their competition went on from about 1904 to about 1911. And it started out with O'Leary was the incumbent. He was there first, and so he felt he had the turf. And they sort of roughed up Mont Tennis. They beat him up one day in 1904, and things sort of escalated from there. Somebody threw a bomb outside of O'Leary's place and blew out all the windows. So O'Leary then sent out his handbook men into the Loop District and started scooping up all of Tennis's business and dynamited Tennis's house. And before you knew it, you had what was known as the Gambler's War in Chicago, which went from about 1904 until 1911. And again, O'Leary was the incumbent, and Tennis was, he was more of a tech disruptor. On the day that the Western Union cut the wire, there's a quote in the Chicago paper from Mont Tennis saying, "Don't worry about it, I got it covered, I'll figure it out, I'll figure out a way to get you your data." And that's what he did. He filled the void, and he took over and figured out a way to bring back the racing wire to the pool rooms and the handbooks. So he was here on the north side, it was a classic rivalry, he was the tech disruptor, O'Leary was the incumbent. O'Leary was buying data, or he needed to acquire data to run his business. Tennis was distributing data. He was selling it. And, you know, in all my research, I can't really find any ties of Jim O'Leary to anyone in baseball. But Tennis and his brothers loved baseball. And he had several brothers. The two most relevant so far, it seems, to the story are William and Charles. And Charles Tennis was a pool hustler, and he managed some of the greatest pool players of the time, particularly a guy named Willie Hoppy out of New York. And in 1909, there was this headline here in Chicago where it said Charles Tennis was planning a world tour in which he was going to take a bunch of Chicago Cubs, a few other major league players, as well as a bunch of pool players, and tour barnstorm around the world. So he had a good relationship with at least a lot of the Cubs players at that time, and there's no evidence that ever ceased or changed for the intervening decade. In 1920, when the story of the Fixed World Series broke, you may remember it started with a Chicago Cubs game, a Phillies against Cubs game, that a pitcher for the Cubs named Claude Hendricks was going to pitch. And they yanked Claude Hendricks because they said he was on the take. And they went and interviewed William Tennis, who was sort of the bookmaking brother in the Tennis family. And William Tennis said, "Oh, yeah, Claude Hendricks, great friend of mine. You know, I go to dinner with him all the time. We're super close." So the Tennis family was extremely involved in bookmaking and baseball at that time. And while the Gambler's War was going on, they really started the first, what I can locate, looks like an attempt to professionally book baseball games in 1908. And then this is the part of the story that I love. They get crushed. I mean, they just get wiped out in 1908. In about 4 weeks, William Tennis and three other bookmakers lose $100,000. And the reason they lost $100,000 was in 1908 is the year of Merkel's boner for the Giants, Fred Merkel, when he misses the base. And the Giants, the Cubs, and the Pirates are all super good that year. They all win at least 98 games. The Cubs take the pennant in the playoff game to make up for the Merkel's boner game. And the public just comes in, and they're just betting these favorites in 3- and 4-team parlays. They're just betting that all three of them will win, and they are. They're just winning day after day after day. And so they picked, like, the absolute worst possible time in baseball history, you know, to start their bookmaking business on baseball. And this still occurs today. I have another slide up there that's just from last August. There's a radio station on XM Radio called the Vegas Sports and Information Network. Brent Musburger and some of his friends have started it. And so they have bookmakers come on all the time and talk. And they had this bookmaker, Nick Bogdanovich, come on in August. And he was talking about this baseball season. And he was talking about the Astros, the Dodgers, and the Yankees. And they were just winning and winning and winning. And he said, you know, I cannot wait for the baseball season to end. It is no fun booking baseball on these big favorites when they just keep winning. And so it gave me a chuckle because I'm thinking, you know, some things just never change. You know, it just never changes. It's still the same today. The other thing that made it difficult for the bookmakers is that baseball is not conducive to betting through a point spread. It's really an odds-based game where you have to pick the outright winner. Whereas in football and basketball, you know, you can pick a team, you can pick the Bears. If you like the Bears, but you don't think that they're 5 points better than the Vikings, you know, you can take the Vikings in the 5 points and bet the game that way. And that's you can do it a little bit in baseball, but it's really pretty hard to do. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, in the early 20th century, they were having such a difficult time getting their books to balance. In 1910, Jim O'Leary, back to the incumbent, he tried to put his hand in baseball. And he took some bets on the World Series that year, which was between the Cubs and the Athletics. And he made the Cubs the favorite. But he only handled about $8,000. He really didn't get a lot of money on the series. He had heard there was someone in Philadelphia who wanted to bet $100,000. So he sent a telegram to Philadelphia that said, hey, if you have $100,000 that you want to bet, I'm your man. You know, come see me. But I haven't found any information that would suggest that he actually got anybody to take him up on it. So what happened next was, two things came along then a few years later. In 1911, at the National Commission meetings in Cincinnati, the magnates and Ben Johnson and that whole crew heard rumors that the bookmakers were going to start what's known as a future book. In other words, they were going to start taking bets on who was going to win the World Series at the beginning of the year, before anybody had played any games. And I'm sure the reason the bookmakers wanted to do that was they wanted more time put into the system so that if they had a bad position, they could get out of it before the games actually got there. Because time and the amount of time that's involved in a bet is absolutely critical. And the other thing that happened in 1911 was the World Series between the A's and the Giants. And it was the first time in New York City where they had a game cast of it. They had the electronic scoreboard, the playagraph that they set up first in Herald Square and then in Times Square. And the playagraph was wildly popular. You know, it brought in big crowds. People who weren't actually at the game could come and see what essentially is the same thing you will see on your phone today, you know, when you log on to ESPN's Gamecast and you watch the game. I follow most of my sports on Gamecast now. I have kids and I'm busy and stuff like that. But bettors, that's their primary way of following the game is to follow a Gamecast. And it wouldn't have been any different 100 years ago. So those two things now have made baseball more appealing to the bettors. It's getting more in the public eye. And of course, in New York City, there's a gambler named Arnold Rothstein who is watching all this happen. And in 1914, Rothstein is sitting at dinner in New York City with a bookmaker named Jack Doyle, who becomes a very famous bookmaker in New York City. And Doyle says, I got a bunch of bets on this team, the Boston Braves. And the Boston Braves, they stunk at the beginning of the year. They had this terrible start, but they've had a pretty good streak now, and they're in fourth place. And Rothstein says, they stink. They're not going to go anywhere. So Doyle says, well, I'll tell you what. He said, you know, I took $300 in on this. I will give you, Arnold Rothstein, $200 if you take over the responsibility to pay these bets if they win. And that's called layoff betting. Okay, when you have, and that's essentially a bet between two bookmakers. And so it's not a B2C transaction. It's not a business to consumer transaction. It's a B2B transaction. And Rothstein says, favorites always win in baseball. It's the easiest $200 I ever made in my life. He does it, you know. He takes over the liability on the Boston Braves. Of course, the Boston Braves go crazy in the National League race. And they don't cool off. And they just keep winning and winning and winning. And so what Arnold does is, you know, he's a smart bookmaker. So before the series gets there and he can see the handwriting on the wall, he goes and he calls Jack Doyle up and says, remember those people, you know, who you said made all these bets? What are their names again? You know, and he goes and he finds them and he pays them off at lower odds than they would if they would win the World Series, except for one guy in Boston who bet $1 at 1,000 to 1 and held onto the ticket and cashed it for $1,000. And so the other thing that Rothstein then does is when the World Series gets there, he makes a bet that today you would call him a bridge jumper, because it's a suicidal bet. He bets $2,000 that the Braves will not sweep the A's, and he will win $100 if the A's can just win one game. All right, and so he's putting up $2,000. The most he'll get back will be $2,100. His original $2,000 plus $100, but he doesn't. I still can't figure out why he did it, but it does show you Arnold Rothstein's mentality. Was he was a very risk-averse person. You know, he was not looking to back the big underdog. He was looking for the sure thing. And of course, the Braves sweep the A's behind Hank Gowdy, who our Columbus, Ohio chapter is named after. And Arnold loses there too. You know, my calculation is that he probably lost between $150,000 and $300,000 in terms of today's dollars on the 1914 World Series. But I'm sure he learned from that. I'm sure that he had learned from that, and the tennis family had learned from that. And what they had learned was, which is still true today, is, you know, the public likes favorites when it comes to betting baseball. So back to Chicago. You know, it's now 1916, and things are starting to get a little shaky for the baseball bookmaker. Judge Landis gets after Mont Tennis here in Chicago. There's a case it spins out of a case totally unrelated to baseball. It involves a bail bond. And they bring in a guy, and it turns out he's a bookmaker working for Tennis's network and getting horse racing data from tennis. And then Landis, you know, gets a hold of that bone like a dog, and he won't let go. And he spends 3 days shaking down everyone who's connected to tennis, and even brings Mont Tennis in and questions him. And Tennis is represented by the famous lawyer Clarence Darrow, and Tennis takes the Fifth Amendment. He refuses to answer any questions. He says that any answer I give may incriminate myself. And he just doesn't say anything. So Landis would really like to stick it to Tennis, but he can't, because there's no law that makes transmitting horse racing information illegal. And that's really what Tennis is still the primary part of his business. In all of this investigation, they discover that there's a national baseball pool going on. It's not Tennis's pool. It's a fellow named Neighbor, but they dig it up, and it's the first time you really kind of see interstate baseball betting, where it's starting to scale and become a national type of business. And they shut down the pool. They say it's an illegal lottery. But Landis really doesn't lay a glove on Tennis. Tennis goes out about his business. Meanwhile, his competitor here in Chicago, O'Leary, he's not having any trouble with the law, but he's just having business trouble, because he's not kept up with technology. And we all know what happens when you don't keep up with technology in business. Your business suffers. And so O'Leary is having difficulty getting horse races to book. And he also liked to book political events. And he had booked the election involving Woodrow Wilson, the 1916 election. And Wilson wins, and O'Leary plays it. He says, I'll pay when it's official. And they say, it's official. He's like, no, the Electoral College hasn't met yet. I'll pay when the Electoral College meets. Electoral College meets, puts Wilson in the White House. O'Leary says, well, just to be sure, I'm going to wait till March until he actually shows up. And so people are now beside themselves. The bettors are. And now it's in the paper, and they're hiring lawyers, and they're going to sue O'Leary, and they're saying he just doesn't have the money. And that's probably true. He probably was, at least for that period of time, he was running low on cash. Let me fast forward to 1919, the summer right before the World Series, and it's more of the same. Mont Tennis is riding high. He has now pretty much monopolized the racing wire. He has a national monopoly on horse racing data, and he takes the train here from Chicago out to Toledo for the big Jack Dempsey, Jess Willard heavyweight title fight. And the next day, the headlines scream, 30,000 on Jack, won by Tennis and even money. So he bets on Dempsey. He goes out on the train. He cleans up. He's coming back. There's cigars, there's caviar, there's champagne. I mean, life is good. Montanus is living large. But Jim O'Leary is the complete opposite. He's trying to set up a pari-mutuel horse race in the little town of Libertyville here in Illinois because he's desperate to get some kind of content that he can bet on. Of course, law enforcement swoops in on him. They shut him down. The whole thing's a fiasco. And he's sort of back to the drawing board. And so that's where the competition, that's where the gamblers' war is as we get to the stretch run of the 1919 pennant race and the World Series. And as some of you may know, it is just barely an aside in the story of the World Series is that Charlie Wiegman, who was the president of the Cubs, tells the grand jury in 1920, hey, in August, you know, a month before the World, 2 months before the World Series, Montanus told me at Saratoga that the series was fixed and the Reds were going to win it. And sure enough, that's what happened. And also what happens in October is there's out-of-town money that comes into Jim O'Leary's handbook on the South Side and bets the Reds like crazy. It's really the most clear place where the Reds really get abnormally strong backing. And it really looks like, just from a business perspective, as I look at this, is that O'Leary is on the ropes and that tennis is finishing him off. Of course, there's never been any, you know, there was no focus on Montanus here in Chicago. Montanus was very well politically connected. And all of that just disappears and becomes a mystery. And it's something that, you know, I know I'll be looking at more and more as we go forward in the future. So how does this all relate to today and what's going on? Well, I have to say that if you look at what Major League Baseball is doing now with betting on its sport, it looks a lot like what Western Union and Montanus were doing with horse racing back in the early part of the 20th century. They are selling data to bookmakers. And that's what Western Union did, and that's what Montanus did. But I think Major League Baseball is a lot more like Western Union than they are like Montanus or Jim O'Leary or Arnold Rothstein. It's a legitimate business that operates transparently and in the open. And, you know, if they never would have got Western Union out of the data business back in 1904, the whole story might have looked a whole lot different. So I think another thing that really makes, and this is a huge difference between now and then, and that is the bookmakers are so much better at this now than Jim O'Leary and Montanus and Arnold Rothstein were then. You know, when you make a bet on the odds, it's typically an 11 to 10 bet, and you can just do the math, and you're going to figure that the bookmaker's going to win 4.5% of the amount of money that's bet. Baseball bettors still to this day do better than other sports. And the hold or the gross win that a bookmaker will hold usually be around 3% for baseball. But they know they're going to get their 3%. You know, it's like clockwork. And so there's really no incentive to fix a baseball game anymore because it's just not worth risking your gaming license to make a few other dollars. Plus, if there was ever anybody who came into a sports book and made a bet that was out of the ordinary. They monitor all the lines now. Both the businesses and law enforcement would be on them like that. And if anybody was able to get through all of that and actually make a huge bet and win a huge bet, the moment someone showed a 20 or 30% profit on baseball, they would come under incredible scrutiny because it just doesn't happen. So there's a lot of differences that are going on right now. I think that to sum it up, what I would say is that, you know, Major League Baseball certainly is channeling some of the spirit of the early 20th century, but the true operational details of what's going on, nothing like that. It's nothing like that. And I think it's a good thing, or at least a neutral thing, that if you just like baseball and you don't want to pay attention to gambling, you might have to tolerate a little bit more of it. Being in the media, but other than that, I don't think it'll change a thing. So thank you.